listening to The People's Show.
Coming to Kane, you best not miss.
Left circle, Besser, one time slot shot, he scores. Brock Besser beats Jordan Binnington on the power play, and the Canucks are up 4-0.
With Seth, Dan, and Randeep.
The biggest thing to hit Canada because the Maple Leafs suck.
On the official home of the Canucks.
Goes all the way down the ice, here's Pettersson after it. He's got a chance at a breakaway. Pettersson in clean, is tripped by Murray, but he scores. Tiki Pete comes out of the box and puts the puck into the back of the net.
Sportsnet 650.
What is going on? Yeah, it's the People's Show. Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah, and Randeep Janda get us on the Dunbar Lumber text line 650. You hear us on your favorite podcatcher as well as Sportsnet 650 is. You can always subscribe, leave a review. That way you never miss a show. Big program coming up. We've got Grant Wall after 4 o'clock. After 5 o'clock, Don Taylor will be joining us. And Ryan Kessler after 6 p.m. tonight. As we'll get his take on the Eddie Lack story that we heard last week. It's the People's Show at Dan Riccio underscore at Satyar Shah and at Randeep Janda. The weather is beautiful. Gentlemen, how much FaceTime audio have you been doing today?
Actually, none. I had to I had to use my girlfriend's phone at one point to make a phone call, and that's the only phone call I've made all day, and that's it for me.
Yeah. All I did was Google Meet, and that's all I need to do, man. I don't call people anyways. I'm that guy.
Well, I guess we did our meeting through via, you know, meeting Zoom,
yes,
type of deal,
yeah,
at noon today.
Yeah. That's the way of the future, I guess. This is totally look at us figuring this out, right? Look at us. I'll say this. Like I go out for my run. I don't know if you guys know this, but I run regularly in the mornings.
Wait, you didn't post a picture today. What's going on?
Sometimes I do it without posting a picture, and I'm telling you now to make sure that you know. But
some would call running driving.
Reach your run.
Yes, the Riccio run. Beamer on the seawall. That's me. And I try to flip on like Spotify or whatever to get the tunes going, and I'm just like, what? I can't like listen to anything because nothing works right now. So it was traumatizing at first.
So if you heard a guy running on the seawall and also singing, that was Dan Riccio.
Singing to myself, yes.
I'm just yelling to the clouds. You know what you got to do when these things happen is you got to download a playlist. Like I did that on my podcast. I actually downloaded the 31 Thoughts pod so I can listen to it on Wi-Fi when the Wi-Fi dropped out.
Smart.
Yeah, Dan, you didn't do it properly.
No,
I did the exact same thing as that. I was prepared. I was ready to go.
I'm not technologically sound when it comes to that.
It's a download button.
You tell people to download our podcast, but you could not download the 31 Thoughts or even a playlist on your own.
I stream it most of the time. What do you want from me? I didn't have any foresight. You know me. All right. This text from Silver and Black Canuck. I was at the seawall all day. Didn't see Dan once, and there's no selfie on Twitter, so I'm calling BS. He did not go for a run.
No electronic proof, so it's a lie.
Keep your texts coming in. We've got a lot coming up on the show and even a fill in the blank as well. But the big story obviously coming out of last night, the Canucks get a dub over the Maple Leafs in their return to play 3-2 in overtime. They overturn the 2-0 deficit against all odds. Braden Holtby has his best game in a Canuck uniform. He was just incredible. The game was incredible. The emotion of it, watching it, was incredible. And it's one, like, I don't know how else to get around it. It seems like hyperbole in the moment, but I don't feel like it is, even 24 hours later. It's like one of those games, even a regular season game, that you'll just never forget.
You know, it's what makes being a fan worth it, these types of moments, right? Where it's raw emotion, utter jubilation, and surprise. Like, I saw somebody post out that this was the most unlikely victory in the NHL in over two decades based on, you know, some analytical models in terms of how high the degree of difficulty was and the mismatch and the oppositions playing each other last night. So it kind of tells you how unlikely it was. And in a season where you haven't had a lot to be proud of as a Canucks fan, it was the ultimate moment of pride to see these guys pull off what seemed like the impossible last night.
And the way it happened, though, right? Because I think everybody within that first 10 minutes of that game, when you saw the Canucks having trouble getting the puck out of their own zone, when they were chasing in their own zone, it looked like it could have gotten pretty bad. They looked tired in the first period, and there was an expectation of, wow, it's going to be ugly. Then they go down 1-0. Then they go down 2-0. And eventually, even though they kind of stabilized themselves in that second period, it still felt like, okay, this could go sideways at any point. But no, the effort, the belief, the spirit within the team, they took it to that next level. And that's what I think, A, it's Toronto. So anytime you beat Toronto and Vancouver is, as you know, everybody knows, it's a big deal. But when you do it under those circumstances where you have so many players that test positive for COVID and they come back and the Leafs were like minus 300 heading into that game to win. Like the betting odds were completely against the Canucks. So if you made a bet on the Canucks yesterday, you won. You made some money. But that was the kind of the whole idea behind it, was that even though everybody else was saying, wow, the bar is low, the Canucks just get through this game. It doesn't even matter if you win. Internally inside that locker room, there was a different set of belief, and you saw that on the ice yesterday. And just, I think as Vancouverites, very proud of those guys, of the way that they competed throughout.
You know, I even just, chatting with a few listeners on Twitter and whatnot, just like, oh, they got caved in. I mean, they didn't deserve to win that game. And it's just like, why, like, do we have to analyze everything in that way where it's just like you can only judge a hockey game based on Corsi anymore? Like that, like last night wasn't about that, it wasn't about that. And it never was going to be about that. You knew the Canucks were up against it no matter what, but they gutted it out. And like, can't you just appreciate a team finding a way to win anymore? Where it has to be like, oh, is this sustainable, what they are doing currently? Like, that was never the storyline for me last night.
Dan, you know what last night was? Last night, from a Canucks perspective, was an Arturo Gatti fight. Stylistically, yeah, there's some flaws. Defensively, they weren't there, but the heart was there. They ended up gutting out that win. It was like an Arturo Gatti knockout win. You might be outboxed in that, but doesn't matter. You came away with the W, and that's what was most important for this team that was up against it. So I get it. But if we're using that boxing analogy, if you win by KO, guess what? You win. You can go look at the punch stats later on and say, wow, you got out of a box. Doesn't matter. You walked away with a W. And given the circumstances that this team was up against, I think any nitpicking of that last night, it falls on deaf ears for me, because they were not expected to be in that game. And the fact that they put up that sort of effort set, that really speaks to the individuals in that room and what they went through, and how much belief they have in themselves.
They had something to rally around, right? And that was the ultimate galvanizing moment for this team. And I think heading into it, they all kind of, I mean, JT Miller himself last week said, I'm not even thinking about playoffs. I don't know how likely they thought it was going to be to win a hockey game. I know Bo said all the right things before the game about how they're going to try to win, and they're here to compete and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, you're going to tell yourself that. But how do you start believing that, even though they were outplayed? And I get Dan's point. Like, we have gotten to the point now with knowing as much as we know about the game and knowing all the underlying numbers and going through all that sort of stuff, that it's very easy to figure out which team outplayed the other team. But that doesn't mean it should take away your enjoyment in how they won that game. It's about the unlikely things happening. And hockey is the ultimate luck sport, too. I mean, how much of hockey is based out of, pure luck with the puck bouncing around a sheet of ice? There's a huge component of luck to every single hockey game that gets played. The best teams are the teams that put themselves in a position to be more lucky than other teams more consistently. But last night, the thing that was really impressive about how they played wasn't just that they found a way to win, was that they started feeding on the emotion of some big moments. Big Holtby save, big Bo Horvat goal, Nils Höglander tying it up. Those moments fueled them, and even though they're outplayed in the large big picture of the game, those key moments where they started pushing back and dictating play were enough for them to score and win. And you should credit them for doing that and finding a way to overcome the challenge and beating the best team in the division.
Joey in Richmond on the Dunbar Lumber text line, 650-650. Not going to lie, when Bo scored, I yelled and jumped off the couch, scared my girl who was watching her own show in another room. Surprisingly, the most invested I had been in a game for a while, was proud to be watching. The buy-in barometer holds steady. So Joey is still all in, invested on the Canucks in the here and now and in the future. And Quinn Hughes even said that after the game last night. You know, it kind of, he referenced that it kind of felt like a playoff game. And I found that a little bit surprising. But, you know, in a moment like that, I don't want to make too much of it. But, you know, what can a win against all odds do for a team? I'm not going to even, I'm kind of like JT Miller. I don't even want to talk playoffs, but what can a win like that do, especially in the context of, you know, things were going a little bit sideways over the last couple of weeks. Guys were angry, all these different stories coming out about how the organization has handled things. What do you think a win like that against all odds can do for just the overall feel of what's going on around the Canucks?
One of the biggest criticisms we had at the beginning of the year of this group was that, you know, last year they were a resilient bunch, but we're not seeing that from this year, you know, from them this year. In that game, though, we saw a resilient team. We saw a team that should have been out of it, and they came together, whether it extends beyond last night's game and turns into the story of their season. But we saw it last year more so on a personal level. You know, there are a number of tragedies that happened with the Vancouver Canucks in their own personal lives. We know about the passing of, you know, some of the fathers on the team. It was tough. It was a very difficult situation for the Canucks, and they banded together as a collective. This year, this moment of having to go through this as a team, having it affect your family and come back to the rink and say, hey guys, we're doing this for each other. We're doing this for, you know, the people in this room. We're doing this for the coach who made passionate comments on Saturday talking about, you know, how the guys were kind of like kids to him. He kind of felt the same way he did, you know, about, he would about his kids with them having to deal with COVID. To me, this really brought the resiliency of this team back into it. And all of a sudden now they said, hey, everybody's counting us out. Bo Horvat said that on as recently as Friday, where that's all right. They can make those comments. People can make those comments, but we are in a position to prove everybody wrong. I think that resiliency and just playing for each other, which we didn't see in January and February, you saw that last night. You saw that yesterday. And I'm not going to go, you know, I've been saying for some time that this is not a playoff team, but what it could do is bring this core together where you end off on a high and you end off the season on a good note, something that we were doubting as recently or 4 or 5 days ago, guys.
You know, ultimately, this is still a really difficult task here for these guys. I mean, we're still talking about 18 games coming up in the next 30 days. So you're talking about a lot of hockey games in a short period of time, and it's not going to be easy to keep that type of energy level up this entire time. I think what last night's game does is it does, like Randeep said, it gives you something to believe in. It is that real moment of belief you need to really get going on a streak to begin with, at the very least, and this can fuel you from an adrenaline and emotional level for perhaps a couple more games, and you can push it as far as you can. But ultimately, they're gonna need to get guys back. I mean, they're undermanned as well last night, right? And maybe it's promising, or depending on how you view it. Elliot Friedman saying Elias Pettersson's season may not completely be over. Does he come back at some point? But I don't think this is so much about do they make the playoffs and go on a big run here. It's more about, does this give them enough energy to get through this tough schedule and at least hold their own? And to me, the marker here is, and I know fans don't want to hear this because they want the best pick possible, but when it comes to this group itself, can you make those final three games against Calgary matter? Can you make those games not just be exhibition games or games that get canceled? Can you stay mathematically alive until those final three games against Calgary?
That's going to be a big test, but like it felt like last night's game. I don't know if you guys do this, but if you know, having a tough morning or just in a bad mood for whatever reason, you wake up, it's really gray out and it's raining, and you're like, it's kind of a downer. Like, you know, you just flip through Instagram, watch a bunch of dog videos, and all of a sudden, okay, yeah, cheer up a little bit. You're like, that's kind of what last night was for me. It's just like, I think we all needed a positive news story just around this team right now to kind of kick it into a different light.
Oh, we did. And, you know, there haven't been many moments here this entire season, guys, where you could sit there and be happy and joyous about what you're watching.
100%.
Like, it hasn't been. And now you had a moment where, even if you're not a Canucks fan, even if you're not a hockey fan, but you knew the story from an emotional human level, it became a human interest story. And when you see people succeed when the odds are against them, I don't care who you are and what your leanings are team-wise or what your allegiances are, you're still going to respect that. And last night was the ultimate moment of respect for a group of individuals and even more so for the fans of that team.
Well, the other thing is that, you know, there's a lot of noise around this organization and most of it wasn't positive over the last couple of weeks. It's nice to just have a good story with this group, and the players deserve it as well. They've gone through a lot. The coaches deserve it as well. They've had to deal with a lot, them and their families, but just a positive story, man. Like 2020, 2021 has been rough. And I know last year the Canucks had some good stories with the playoff run, and it was a success. It was deemed a success. They made some inroads, and then the offseason comes around. And since then, essentially, it's been a pretty rough situation. This was a good moment. This was an opportunity where you could say, all right, these guys deserve some good, and here it is. So just basically, it was a moment where you could say, finally, something good has happened.
It is the People's Show. Keep coming in on the Dunbar Lumber text line. Langley Fun Guy, apparently having a lot of fun. He says, good morning, gentlemen.
Okay, just woke up. Maybe he works the graveyard shift. We don't know that.
We don't know. Finally, a game to talk about. So excited. Where to begin? Yesterday's game was one on pure raw emotion from everything they've gone through in the past few weeks. And love hearing texts like that. Keep them coming. 650, 650 on the Dunbar Lumber text line. And where does the Canucks win last night rank amongst regular season victories? We'll discuss coming up as well. Now, I did want to get to this from 31 Thoughts, the podcast, as we referenced earlier, Elliot Friedman. And, you know, he dropped the big nugget on headlines Saturday night, Hockey Night in Canada, that a lot of the Canucks players, or some of the Canucks players, were upset with how things had been handled and the lack of communication. Here he is on 31 Thoughts, clarifying and where things went sideways with things through this COVID outbreak.
Look, it was the biggest story in the league this week, no question about it, after the trade deadline and JT Miller going public with his comments saying that we're not ready to play and we shouldn't play. And that night, Wednesday night, the players said the same thing to the Players Association on a Zoom call. They said, we are willing to return this season, but we are not willing to return as soon as Friday night against the Edmonton Oilers. Now, what I think was supposed to happen, guys, is that this was supposed to come down to Thursday morning. And on that day, 17 of the Canucks were supposed to go through their mandatory post-COVID examinations, the heart tests, everything that you have to go to be cleared to play. And that's what I believe the plan always was. We'll see where everybody was on Thursday morning, and then we'll all make the decisions. Well, on Thursday morning,
All right, this was the wrong click, played by accident. That was headlines from Saturday night. Here is Elliot Friedman on 31 Thoughts.
Well, you know, obviously the players were right to say they needed a couple more days. You know, I think there were a couple of things that came up. You know, I now believe, I don't know how serious it was, Jeff, but I now believe it at least was discussed from the players. Like, do we have to play 56 games? Could we play, I don't know, I'm throwing a number out there, 51 or something like that. I don't know how seriously it was discussed, but I think it was kind of thrown out there just as an option. But I think they were clearly right to say, as they did to the Players Association, we'll be okay if we get a couple extra days. And I think where it went sideways, and this is where I think some of the frustration came from, is I think the league, the Players Association, and the Canucks, along with their medical staff, had discussed the likelihood that they weren't going to know if they were going to play on Friday until they went through all their medicals on Thursday. Mm-hmm. As part of the protocols, when you come out of the COVID reserve list, you have to pass a mandatory post-COVID exam. And, you know, it's basically a physical, and it's also testing on your heart, the ECGs, the electrocardiograms, all of that stuff. And from what I understand, the league and the Players Association, they felt that it was understood that Friday was no guarantee until Thursday. But for whatever reason, that was not explained clearly enough to the players. And so the players are sitting here saying, we're going to play in 2 days, really? So when Miller said what he said, I think the reaction in some other circles was, wait a sec, like, why is this being said? Because aren't the players supposed to recognize that we're not going to be making this decision until tomorrow? And Matthew Schneider was on from the NHLPA, was on with David Amber in our pregame, and he basically said the same thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's why I think things kind of happened the way they did. I think the communication broke down and there was a lot of frustration about the fact that communication broke down. Like, imagine the players being frustrated, not getting that message properly and what you're thinking while most of you are battling illness and coming out of it and your families are doing the same thing. So I totally understand the frustration of the players. And now I have a better understanding of the frustration from outside because they thought this was all agreed to.
That is Elliot Friedman on 31 Thoughts, the podcast, now available for download from this morning. It really does explain where things broke down here. And I think we were kind of getting at that late last week, Sats, at least with some of your reporting, you were as well. But this is, you know, it's kind of, it's disconcerting to say the least that, you know, the communication lines just weren't properly handled between players, organization, and league.
You know, I think the biggest thing here, and we kind of alluded to this last week, because, you know, I mentioned that I heard a similar thing to what Elliot mentioned, that there was an understanding, at least from management and the organization standpoint, that it was always going to come down to Thursday's medicals. And whether JT Miller spoke out publicly or not, there was a good chance the games would be postponed because it was unlikely all those players, given what they've gone through physically and how they felt on the ice and cardiovascular wise last week, that it was unlikely they would get enough guys past, you know, physically and medically to be able to play the game on Friday. So the organization was kind of under that understanding. The issue here is whether it was not communicated or not communicated properly, or if the communication didn't sink in for whatever reason, or perhaps there wasn't trust that they would actually be able to rely that this would actually happen with the medical team going through all that process. I don't know what the real issue here was, but clearly the communication, if it was there or not, wasn't effective enough. And that's the issue that angered a lot of guys. That's something we heard too. And that communication thing has been something that we can point to when it comes to this organization for quite some time now. And maybe that's because they have a pretty thin front office now. There's a lot of guys trying to do a lot of work, and maybe they're not communicating that thing as well as they've done in the past. But the weird thing here is the process, the protocols were in place, and it seemed like there was an understanding league-wide, and at least from the organization standpoint, that things would get delayed if guys weren't ready. Why did the players not feel or know that message? That's the issue here more than anything else. And yeah, I do think some guys are pissed, but I also don't think that it's this thing where every single player wants out or every single player is so mad and upset at the organization. Certain guys might be more upset than others, and some of those feelings may go back to the offseason and how that unfolded as well. But it's more about them feeling like they weren't fully being kept in the loop, whether that was willful or not from the organization standpoint. That's what they have to kind of fix moving forward.
Well, Sat, also, you know, during this time, especially when, you know, I can't speak for the players involved, but stressful time as it is when you're going through this, and then you have this uncertainty of when are we playing, you know, are we safe enough to play right now, maybe we need more time. The communication factor and the fact that you don't know something, yeah, obviously kind of wears on you. So I can understand it. Even, you know, looking at our own professions, whatever we may do in life, when your employer doesn't maybe communicate or you haven't received that message clearly, whether whoever's fault it is, I don't know the ins and outs of that. You can rely on what you've reported and Elliot's reported, but absolutely, right? Like, you're going through a stressful situation as it is, and then for whatever reason you have this uncertainty of, sorry, we're gonna play on potentially Saturday and Friday. I don't think we're ready. Maybe these are thoughts that you have, and there's this kind of this big mystery of what's going on here. Why aren't we in the loop? I can understand the frustration, but I'm curious to, I don't know when we hear about the full story, you know, beyond that. But yeah, there is clearly a communication gap here in this case. And even with Bo Horvat's comments last week, where he was asked about the organization, course, you think about those comments and him not making those comments specifically about the team or the organization a little bit differently, right? You do now after hearing more of this reporting from Elliott to say, yeah, players were affected. You definitely pay a little bit more attention to those comments that weren't made by Bo. So it's an interesting perspective. You can see the team maybe rallying together and finishing off the season right to end off the year. But yeah, you do have to wonder of where is their psyche beyond, you know, maybe they're a cohesive unit, but that communication gap that clearly was the case last week, has that been sorted out? Is that still a bit of an elephant in the room when you're talking about the Canucks organization?
It's also like the, you know, it goes alongside a narrative that there hasn't been great communication from this management group in a lot of other areas, right? When we think back to free agency and things like that, where Troy Stetcher was like, you know, there wasn't a lot of talk, and Tyler Toffoli moving on, and there was this constant theme of poor communication going through there. And so I'm not entirely surprised that this is something we're hearing coming out, but you've just got to find a way to be better. You know, if this is something that could have solved or have been solved or handled better, just simply on communicating the situation better with your employees, and this is something a lot of businesses struggle with, let's be honest, but if that's something that can simply be solved by better communication, then you've got to take note of that and be better about it moving forward. Stan Riccio, Satyar Shah, and Randeep Janda, The People's Show, getting some texts about Alex Edler's two-game suspension. We'll go over that. We've got a fill-in-the-blank. Beating the Leafs is blank. Have some fun with it. We'll get to your responses throughout the course of the show, get to some of ours as well. Plus, the biggest story on sports Twitter right now, European soccer giants heading towards a Super League. Grant Wall will join us after 4 o'clock. It is The People's Show on Sportsnet 650.
You're listening to The People's Show with Sat, Dan, and Randeep on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Yeah, it's The People's Show with you. The Dunbar Lumber text line, 650-650. The smart alternative is a Dunbar Lumber on Bridge Street in Ladner or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. This text, unsigned, comes in. How does Edler get two games, but Matthews doesn't even get 2 minutes for a worse knee? Superstar Leaf versus veteran Canuck, I guess. Were we at all surprised at the heavy suspension? Pretty heavy from what I can gather. Alex Edler getting two games from the NHL Department of Player Safety.
Yeah, I thought maybe he'd get one game, considering he already got the game misconduct. And, you know, he scored one goal on that five-minute major. Not to say that it was, you know, justice completely, but I thought that is essentially a half a game suspension, right? And in the moment, that's a big blow to your team, the way Edler goes down, and you get another two games. I don't know if it's excessive, but it's definitely on the high end. Generally speaking, on situations like this, I'm not against supplemental discipline, like on shots where guys get hit, you know, get injured to that degree, whether it's a headshot or somebody dragging a knee. I don't really have a problem with them giving a guy an extra game. Had that been a Canucks player and the roles were reversed, I'd probably sit here and say, you know what, maybe it's more than I expected, but I'm glad they this is the way they went, so I'm not going to be a hypocrite about it. So I think the two games, maybe more than I thought, but I don't have a problem with them levying suspension on a hit that was clearly illegal and led to a potentially significant injury for a guy.
Yeah, I'm okay with this. So the Zach Hyman injury, we'll have to see you know, how bad, or, you know, according post-game, they said, Hyman said to John Tavares that he was optimistic. We'll see what that means. But it was a bad hit. Was it malicious? Was it dirty? No, it was a tired and slow player. How many times have we seen Alex Edler stick out his leg because he's stuck in the neutral zone and he can't catch up or he's tired? It wasn't malicious. It was just a way to slow down that opposing player. It was interference, but poorly timed. So, yeah, it's bad, but I'm okay with two games. You know, Edler does have a suspension history going back a while.
It's like 8 years ago. Come on. Like,
but why, doesn't matter. Still people, but still,
this is the weirdest thing to bring up.
Though, no, but my point is, though, he's also got a history, but he's also done this in other moments where he's tired or he's flat-footed. But this is a guy that does this quite often. We've seen it.
He gets
it,
lots
so,
of tripping penalties.
Exactly. True. And, you know, generally it's lower on the leg, but he does this often. So if you're trying to send a message saying, hey, dude, we know you're on our radar, you maybe need to stop doing this because this time it could cause a guy to be out for a while. I'm okay with two games. I got no problem with it.
The thing that frustrates most people is the wheel of injustice or justice that's just completely unpredictable from the NHL, right? And this is why people text in and say, you know, if it was a Leaf fan who did it, if it was a Leaf who did it, there would be no suspension. That's coming into our Dunbar Lumber text inbox, 650-650. And I totally understand that sentiment. And there was a reason fans believe that because it's so inconsistent the way they levy out suspensions all the time.
Mm-hmm. And that will forever be the issue with Department of Player Safety. If that was a Bogosian on Nils Höglander, yeah, you might have a case on that. But given the player in question, the incident in question, it could be a greasy hit. It, like, you know, it wasn't, the intent wasn't there, but the result, it doesn't matter sometimes. And Alex Edler, hard-hitting defenseman when he wants to be. He's got a rep of, you know, at some point, playing a pretty clean game. He's almost at 1,000 games, and he doesn't get suspended that often. But he's a hard hitter, and people know that in the NHL. So when you do that, and he's done that even a couple of times this year where the point of contact is lower on the leg, but people pay attention to that. So that's who Alex Edler is. He's not a dirty player. It was just poorly timed. I'm okay with that because could have been a dangerous hit, man. Could have been a real game changer for Zach Hyman, and could have been even a more serious injury depending on what it comes out with. Two games, I'm all right with that.
Friend of the show, Chris Johnston, just tweeting that Zach Hyman, a sprained MCL, and will miss a minimum of 2 weeks. So Edler gets two games. We have Rob in Richmond. Rob, you're on the People's Show. You got a thought on Alex Edler?
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. This is the thing with Edler. I mean, unfortunately, he's one of those defensemen that the Canucks have, well, one of the few defensemen, only defensemen that they have, that they can count on him for minutes, usually, unless he gets tired, he gets stuck out on a shift like he was last night. And he does stupid things like penalties. You know, he'll hook, he'll hold. Last night, he's not a dirty player, but there was intention there. And, yeah, good, he got two games. I think that's about right. But I think the coaches need to sort of instill or insert other players, right? Like Chatfield looked like he played pretty decent last night. Good minutes.
Thanks for the call, Rob. Yeah, so this was kind of the interesting thing. You know, Myers played up to, what was he, just under 30 minutes before overtime started?
You're right. After overtime was just over 30.
In regulation plan, 30 minutes, mm-hmm. playing essentially half the game. Like Travis, maybe if it wasn't as close as it was, maybe he does trust some of the younger guys a little bit more. But given the situation, I was kind of surprised Travis leaned on his vets like he normally does.
Yeah, and I do think in a situation like that, it probably shouldn't be as surprising considering in moments of big adversity or uncharted waters, really, what do coaches normally do? They'll lean on guys who've been through some experience, has been through a lot of different things in the National Hockey League. So I can understand why he was leaning on Myers to that degree. But to the caller's point, I like what Jalen Chatfield did last night. You know, not just in terms of how he played. And I know from the metrics it wasn't a pretty night, but you always had to assume they were going to get caved at times last night. Mm-hmm. They're never going to dictate play and go out there and you know, be the better team, even against the Leafs, really. I mean, especially against the Leafs. So I think that's an unrealistic expectation and bar to kind of evaluate them on. But I did like what I saw from Chatfield. And we haven't really seen Chatfield get another chance because he started off really well earlier this season. Then he struggled. He got benched. Then he really get into the lineup again. And for young players, and I know he's a bit older and he's been playing pro in the AHL for a while, but he hasn't had a chance to work through things in the NHL. And he's not going to be this, you know, bona fide top four guy long term, but there is enough stuff there that he could maybe be a third pair guy or a good depth option for you. And let's see what he does the last little bit. And I hope last night's performance from guys like him to the coaching staff, to Rob's point who called in, maybe they're not afraid of leaning on those guys a bit more as long as they can handle those minutes like Chatfield did last night.
Especially, you know, you're looking at a guy that played 15 minutes, but I think the long-term buy-in or the long-term success you want to see from these guys and some of these players, whether it's Chatfield, you levy it at a certain point, and Guillaume Brisebois as well, is that if you're a third-pairing guy on the Canucks, if you need to jump up and play more minutes and play tougher matchups, can you do that? Not for a long time, but can you, in the time of injury, or in this case where Alex Edler is thrown out of the game, can you jump up and can you play a meaningful role on a team and provide that support. And yesterday, Jalen Chatfield did that. You know, Guillaume Brisebois played less minutes, but for the most part, yeah, they were a team that was not going to go shot for shot with the Toronto Maple Leafs, but the Canucks counterpunched and they got back into that game, and that's how they ended up winning. They weren't going to land the same type of haymakers, but when they did, when they threw their haymaker, they generally scored. And you need defensemen that could just jump up if they're required to play in a top four position or a few more minutes per game. Can they do it? And can they, you know, just make sure that they don't leak goals? And that's really the for the remainder of the season, whether the Canucks actually make a bit of a playoff push or whether they fall back into the standings. That's what I want to see from some of these young guys, those bubble players that may be on ELCs or on cheap contracts, is down the road, heading into next year, can you be relied on to be that, maybe that Troy Stetcher type of player, where all of a sudden, yeah, he was most comfortable in a third pairing role, but you could rely on Stetcher to jump up when needed. You didn't want him there every single game, but you could rely on him to make that jump if needed. I think some of those guys, Chatfield, Brisebois, and of course, Ollie Levy, have to kind of show that they can be counted in that role going forward.
Lots of texts coming in. Craig in Maple Ridge, how about last year when Josh Levo got the knee, got his knee injured in a dirty play? Texter Craig saying, if I'm not mistaken, it was against the Maple Leafs. That was against the Vegas Golden Knights. I believe it was a play with Nick Holden along the boards that resulted in Josh Levo's injury. And yeah, that's part of it. You know, the NHL and the Department of Player Safety doesn't get them all. And that's why it's always when they go after your guy, it feels a little bit like, woe is me. And now, you know, like, and this kind of goes into the conversation of like, what do you do with Edler long term? He clearly has his flaws and doesn't have the foot speed, and he gets himself into sticky situations like that one and ends up taking penalties a lot. Is this a reason to move on from Edler? Like, this, not this play specifically, but the fact that, you know, over the last couple of years, he's been one of the guys that he has been their leading penalty minute player through the last couple of seasons. Is this just something where you're like, this foot speed is a problem for Alex Edler right now with this Canucks team?
To me, all this stuff is kind of the wrong question to be asking. It's more about, why can't they move on from Alex Edler? That's the real question here. And the reason they can't is because they don't have anybody else that can really step into those minutes yet. Does Jack Rathbone show something? Like, I'm a huge fan of his potential, and I think we're going to be really excited when we get to see Jack Rathbone play in the NHL, and there's a lot he's going to do to develop and get better. I'm really high on him. But he's one guy coming up. Can he replace Edler's minutes next season? Who's the guy that's replacing Edler's minutes next year? Now, we can sit here and say Edler's not good enough anymore. He's playing too many minutes. They need to find somebody else. But they haven't been able to find a succession plan yet. And until you have a succession plan or an improvement that you bring in to play on, over top of him, that's why he keeps coming back. Now, I do think legacy players, there's a way to bring them back and reduce their role. Maybe he plays on a third player pair, plays 17, 18 minutes a game, for instance, right? You maybe rest him every once in a while. I think there's a way to bring him back and be part of the fold. But the big question is, if you bring Edler back, can you have somebody else in place where you're not forced into playing him over 20 minutes a game?
Well, that's really the big question here, is that you can not be a fan of his foot speed and the fact that he doesn't really have that speed anymore, but who's going to eat 20 plus minutes per game? Who's going to play on the penalty kill, play those tough minutes? And a guy that generally still has a pretty significant responsibility on this team. And Rathbone's going to be good, but come on, year one, is he going to be able to play, you know, that many minutes? Probably not. And Quinn Hughes is a great example of a young player that stepped in and started playing a lot of minutes. But as we saw this year, this is a guy that still had to kind of, you know, it was the second year was a learning curve defensively. There was a steep learning curve. So I like Rathbone as well, Sap, but I think Alex Edler, ideally, you want him to be playing on that third pair at some point, and somebody shows that they can play better than him and that his foot speed is an actual problem for this team. And then you diminish that role. Maybe he's playing 15 minutes a game, but as of right now, a one-year deal for Alex Edler, hopefully on a Zdeno Chara type of discount that he was getting in Boston, would make it work, because I still think he's needed. And it's those tough minutes that we often forget about, that, okay, Quinn Hughes is playing power play, Tyler Myers is playing power play. Where does Alex Edler fit? Well, he fits 5-on-5 and on the penalty kill, because the guy is still eating minutes. He's a horse out there.
Lots of texts coming in. Terry and Langley. Come on, guys. Jimbo's got 3-5, 2-5 with a full no move waiting for Edler.
On that, one thing I will say, and I mentioned this a while back, when the negotiations were going on, when they signed Alex Edler, you know, back a couple of years ago to that 2-year contract, $6 million per season, was that once this contract ends, now you can't have, you know, agreements behind, you know, the scenes and all that sort of stuff, but there was talk that once this contract is over, maybe they look at a over 35 bonus laden contract, for instance, where he signs, you know, 1 or 2 years, and then, you know, you have, you know, you sign a 1-year contract, and maybe for $2 million, then there's a couple bonuses that brings it up a bit higher. I think there is a way to sign Edler, and I think if they do bring him back, it would be a bonus laden type of contract if they can agree to something.
It is the People Show. Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah, and Randeep Janda. Keep those texts coming in, and we'll get to more of them. Don Taylor's going to join us after 5 o'clock. We've got Not Saying, Just Saying after 4:30, and Ryan Kessler as well. Some interesting comments from Kevin Bieksa on the morning show today. Obviously, Quinn Hughes, not the happiest about the IV story that he says is untrue. We'll talk to Kessler about that whole relationship with the media and that sort of thing as well, coming up through the course of the program. Our fill in the blank today, beating the Leafs is blank. We'll get to some of those as well. But I did want to get to this just before, you know, Grant Wall is going to join us at the top of the hour. And I wanted to introduce this story a little bit ahead of time just to really bring people in on it. And I'm sure, you know, it's been the talk of the sports world over the last 24 hours as it's developed. But 12 of the biggest European soccer clubs in England, Italy, and Spain have decided, you know what, we're just going to, like, create our own Champions League, essentially. And it's going to be closed. We plan on having 15 teams that are participating every single year, and then 5 rotating in that qualify each season. Essentially, what they are trying to do is, from what I can see and how I've looked at it, is they look at the North American Sports League model and they're like, we want more of that. You know, guaranteed games, guaranteed revenues, all these things that come with a closed league like the NFL. And that's what they want to sell. They see tremendous growth opportunity from a global landscape as well with that. But it brings up the question, is there a point where the greed and business of growing revenues turns you away from your favorite sport, club, whatever it may be?
You know, I don't know if it will ultimately take me to that point, because, hey, we're fans of teams in closed sports leagues in North America, NHL, NBA, NFL, MLB, right? I mean, that's the model. So we're going to be fans of teams in that model, then all of a sudden, you know, turn our backs. But it does take away the essence of what European football is all about. And I think, as much as you're right, it's about streamlining those revenues, taking away the middlemen, which are the federations, you know, FIFA, UEFA, and all that sort of stuff that take a lot of the money these big clubs bring to the table. So I understand it from that perspective. But what you eventually end up doing is watering down your product, because you take away from the growth potential of every single club and football factory across Europe, which is going to hurt development. When you don't have as much money and investment in each one of those countries and smaller towns and even mid-sized towns and soccer-crazed markets, you're going to hurt development of soccer over time. And one of the problems the leagues have in North America is you almost don't have enough good talent at times. Like, how many teams are lacking in talent? You can't find enough good players. And the product at times is great, but at times it's very lacking. And as much as fun as the NFL is, oftentimes the NFL is also very mediocre in terms of parity, teams being at the same level. I think over time, you take away the real essence and value of soccer, which is its global growth, its immense talent, and how it creates a different level of fandom and attention over time. And I think as much as the money grab is scintillating, I think you're doing a bigger disservice to the sport long term.
Well, soccer, especially European soccer, is rooted in the supporters. It's rooted in being something more than a business. As outrageous as that sounds, I know, for a lot of businessmen, that's the essence of European soccer. And listen, My team is involved in this. Riccio, yours is, Sats is, Bix is. But I'm very critical of this. And the way that they did this was at 10:30 Germany time, which is Central Europe. It was kind of like a military coup. They come up with a statement in the middle of the night. They shock fans, the federations, and the leagues, who are not good guys in a lot of ways. I get it. There's certain federations that are bad guys here as well. UEFA is not a clean organization. But this was a move that was rooted in brazen greed. It's the world's richest and most powerful club saying to the rest of the world, we don't need you. We're going to do our own thing. And the way I look at it is, it's arrogant. It shows greed. And it basically says to the rest of the teams in, you know, Europe that, yeah, we don't need you. We've built this. We can do it on our own. And I'm not joking when I say that. It felt like a military coup where they all of a sudden had the relationships. And within a couple hours, it was happening. So I'm not a fan of this, even though my team is a part of this. I'll be honest. Arsenal has no business being in this group. If you're justifying it by saying, the 12 best clubs in the world are going to be involved, and PSG and Bayern Munich said, no, thank you, we don't want to be involved in this, and those are legit two of the top five clubs in the planet, and Tottenham Hotspur and Arsenal in it, give me a break. This is a cash grab, and then some.
I think it's hard to say that there are teams like PSG and Bayern and certainly UEFA taking some kind of moral high ground because, you know, they don't have exactly the best histories. Maybe less so with Bayern Munich, but come on, PSG's got stakes in the game. They basically own beIN Sports Media, and they show Champions League across the world and make a ton of money from it. So, you know, there's a lot that goes on this, you know, and goes into this. But they're at a realization where these clubs have become bigger than the sport itself in their own domestic leagues. And it's wild to think, but, you know, Juventus has won 9 straight Italian league titles. Bayern Munich has won 8 straight German league titles. The competition part of this is very much up for debate. And that is why it's become a conversation.
Yeah, but this isn't about competition. This is about money. You know, we talked
about
this
on
Friday.
Everything's
about
money.
We talked about this on Friday of why the European soccer model does not work. It's the haves versus the have-nots. And you see what happens when that system happens. The haves are saying, screw you to the rest of the continent. And this has created anarchy in European soccer. It's not good. And this is why I stand by, like, a system without structure is bad for the game. This ain't good for soccer. This is terrible for soccer.
It's lasted 150 years.
Well, it had. No, it's true. But, I mean, it's about... So the NFL model is 32 teams. Like over 30, yeah, there are 30 teams in the NFL.
Yeah.
So you're going to have 15 clubs, 20 clubs, and
yep.
then you're going to get it up a bit higher at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like I get it, but at the same time, what's going to happen to those clubs too? Like, are we going to be talking about a salary cap coming in for those clubs? Is that going to be the next thing that they're going to be putting into place to really make sure that within those 30 clubs, it's not going to be the same 4 clubs that dominate all the time, which is going to be Real Madrid, Barcelona, if PSG decides to join, if Bayern mm-hmm. decides to join, which they haven't yet. It's still going to be those teams that are the haves. So are they going to decide then to create a salary cap as well for that league? To make sure that every single one of those clubs has a chance to win, because I'm telling you right now, if you don't, then essentially gonna be the top 4 or 5 clubs anyways in that Super League. It's gonna be the same thing on a grander scale that we see now.
It's fascinating, and you know, it will have whatever happens here will have implications on other major sports around the world. Hey, golfers, get great Vancouver golf for less. Go to discountgolfcard.ca for all the details and to order your Vancouver discount golf card today. Coming up, Grant Wall on the People Show, more on the Super League that is taking over sports talk right now. It's Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah, Randeep Janda, Sportsnet 650.